A couple of minutes, I want you to think about a trigger word for you. A trigger word. Just what is a trigger? What triggers emotions for you? What triggers either joy or trauma or anxiety or excitement? So either for good or bad, what is a trigger word? One word. And then I'll tell you mine. Okay, come on, let's have some examples. If you can bear to share the feelings that go with this trigger word and say it out loud, confess it. Anybody's trigger word?
Immature.
Immature? What, have you been called immature, Dylan? Yeah. Okay. Immature. Social distancing. Oh, yes. Triggering all those images and thoughts and times during the pandemic. Yes. Okay.
Ungrateful.
Okay. Is that because you've been called ungrateful? No, perhaps labels that we have been given. Yes.
Boris.
Yes. That's a great trigger word. Yeah. Anger, resentment, bitterness, hatred. Yeah, sorry, let go there. It's just triggered me. You see, that's exactly what it does. Okay, any more? Come on. Oh, okay, yes. Yeah, that's good. So you kick back against it. I like that. Yes, yeah. Okay, Natalie. Future. Oh, that's a deep one. Yeah, future. Scared of the future, you know, or excited for the future. Anybody else?
Sassy.
Is that because you're sassy? Yeah. You Coventry people, you're so sassy. How many times have you heard that? My trigger word is relegation. I'm not even going to go there. I've been living it all weekend. So, yes, well, actually, for the last 45 years. Okay, so the trigger word that we're going to look at today from Leviticus, and those that have put the dots together, is this word, holiness. I want to today detox holiness. We have an unholy relationship with holiness. So I want to reclaim the word holiness, because as we looked at a few weeks ago, actually before we went to Australia, Leviticus is saturated with the language of holiness. We can't avoid it. And some of our Christian background and discipleship may have been incorporated around the concepts of holiness and learning and living in holiness. The art of that is fundamental to the book of Leviticus. And so we all have a concept of holiness in our minds. Just as all the words that we've shared triggers emotions, then the word holy, I think for me, or holiness, triggers all sorts of emotions. That may be good or it may be bad, but I suspect the word holy triggers all sorts of bad feelings and emotions. So if I said to you, are you a holy person? Now, our friend Ivor's funeral on Thursday, he was described as a holy person. I thought, nah, you don't know him. But in actual fact, he was, by the definition that I'll come to in a moment. So what is the holiness concept in our head? Is it moral goodness? Is it piety? Is it the sense of abstinence from doing certain things? The sort of discipleship of Christianity in the 50s and 60s that you didn't smoke and you didn't swear and you didn't drink and you didn't go to the pictures on Sunday and you didn't do all this thing. Holiness was couched in the language of abstinence and not doing. And so the word holy has become weaponized and toxic and loaded, because it could simultaneously mean things that are boring or things that are terrifying at the same time, or even things that are unattainable. Who's a holy person that comes to mind? First person that comes to mind. Sorry? Desmond Tutu, yes. Mother Teresa, classic holy person. Mahatma Gandhi, another classic. Boris Johnson, no. So, concepts of Leviticus, concepts of holiness in Leviticus, of purity and cleanliness. Thank you. The whole idea of purity adds to our loaded, weaponized concepts of holiness. That sin pollutes us and defiles us and makes us unholy. And so purity has its own triggering rhetoric. But purity and uncleanness is part of the rhetoric and the concepts in Leviticus. And a few weeks ago, we already debunked some of the holiness-purity rhetoric, saying that actually purity, when it comes to the temple and the tabernacle of God's presence, is about objects and people become ritually clean and not necessarily morally clean. So priests particularly and other people in the Levitical community and the Israelite community had to become holy, had to become sacred, had to become pure in order to inhabit sacred space. And so Leviticus pivots from this central idea that God is holy, therefore you, we, the Israelite community should be holy. And so our holiness derives from the OG of holiness. Bit of urban slang there. Darcy used the word OG, didn't you, a few days ago, and I mentioned that a friend Ivor was the OG of creativity. The OG is urban slang, if you don't know already, for those old and crusty people here. Original gangster is actually the word OG. It's the whole idea that old school, exceptional, originator, okay? So God is the originator of holiness. He's the exceptional, set-apart person in holiness. And another good metaphor for God's holiness is the sun. And the Bible Project have done a really good video on this and taken some of those thoughts from there. So the sun is unique in our solar system. It's exceptional. There's nothing like the sun in our solar system. And it sustains and is the source of all life in our solar system. And so we get the whole idea in the set-apartness of the sun in our solar system. And therefore it is holy in one sense. And God being the creative force and energy behind the whole of the solar system, behind the universe, as the one who is the set-apart source and sustainer of all life. So holiness, first of all, and we're going to get to a definition, is shorthand for God's uniqueness, God's otherness, and God's set-apartness. So God is the OG of holiness. He's the original God of holiness. Okay? It's a bit corny, I know. Holiness also is shorthand for God being the ultimate fullness of everything. And we've already had, so brilliantly as an introduction, although Bethany didn't know this, must be God somewhere in that, the whole idea of God being spacious and expansive. Take that a little bit further, we have the concept, therefore, that God is the completeness, the fullness of everything. He is limitless abundance and life and beauty and power. He is the sum and source of everything. But like the sun, as we worked out last week, God's holy presence is also dangerous. Proximity to the sun is dangerous. And you don't need to leave our Earth's atmosphere to realise just how dangerous the sun is. Ask James. Shown with permission. This was James in Bantry last year. This was taken not in some sun-kissed beach in the Mediterranean, but this was in Bantry in west of Ireland, where he got sunburnt so badly. And hats off to whatever suntan lotion he was wearing, because obviously it did a good job of the top part, but not on the bottom half, which he neglected to put on. Won't be tired anybody who actually did that and not did it the rest of it. I know it was. Yeah, it was. So that was the sun's effect of the danger, the power of sun. And, of course, last week we looked at the proximity to sacred space. We looked at the dangers of sacred space, the nuclear plant of God's holiness, and also, as another metaphor now, the sun of God's holiness. So sacred space in Leviticus is or should be protected from violation, from the trespass of people that are impure and unholy. And last week we heard the story of the strange fire, the unauthorized coals that were brought into sacred space by Nadab and Abihu, and they were destroyed and consumed because they violated the boundary of sacred space, of holy space. So this is just important context at the moment. So you've got where I'm coming from. I need to be on board and on side here because we're moving into a progression of what is holiness and how it affects us. So going back to Leviticus, in order to understand a little bit about what is holiness and what is impure and what is pure, we need to look at some of the concepts of what makes us impure and unholy within the Levitical guidelines and regulations. So if you want to turn to Leviticus chapter 12, please, we're not actually going to read any of this, but I just want you to perhaps, while you're listening to me, skim over some of the sort of those little headlines you get in the Hebrew Bible, which aren't actually in the Hebrew Bible, but give you a guide as to what that section is all about. And we get an idea of what is unholy and impure from some of these regulations. So, chapters 12 to 15, if you're skimming through it, outlines particular conditions or states which make people, remember this is people in the ancient world, a long way away geographically and a long time ago, which made them polluted, ritually unclean, and needing to be purified. And there are three specific things, three areas which the Levitical code, the holiness code, points to as what needs to be made pure. First of all, bodily discharges. Who'd have thought that Sunday morning we'd be talking about bodily discharges? What joy. So, some of the things that include in bodily discharges, women's menstrual cycle makes women unclean. Having a baby makes women unclean. They can't touch anything, can't touch objects, household objects or beds or anything else. If they do after their menstrual cycle or during the menstrual cycle or having a baby, that object becomes unclean and their offering needs to be made. Men's ejaculation after sex or any other time they need to offer a sacrifice and become involved in ritual cleansing and purification. So bathing and beds, all of that is unclean. And so any pus that's emitted from your body, even spit on occasions, was deemed to be unclean. Bodily discharges. Ooh. Okay. Secondly, skin diseases. Chapter 13. This is not leprosy. Let's get this clear. Leprosy, there was not a concept of what we know as Hansen's disease now in ancient Israel or in New Testament first century Israel. So leprosy has been a catchphrase interpretive technique which actually really just describes a whole host of skin diseases. So if you've got a scab or a wart, you've got eczema, you've got boil, you've got a swelling, you've got an itch, or you've got a spot, you've got to go to the priest and have it checked out to see whether it's unclean. It's likely to be unclean. It's likely to banish you from the community. You've got to do purification rituals and all that kind of thing. So skin diseases. And then finally, corpses. You can't touch a dead person, a dead animal, or a dead thing like that. You need to be ritually made clean. So all of these are laid out here. Bodily discharges, skin diseases, and corpses. What do you think is the common thread to all of these unclean, polluted, unholy conditions and states? Sorry? Yeah, nearly. They're physical, yeah? Yeah, yeah, so there's something that goes through the community. They all are to do with the loss of life force. The loss of life force. So blood, the loss of blood, was deemed to be in the ancient world a loss of life. The spilling of semen was a loss of life. Skin, which is diseased and decaying, is a loss of life. So everything that is discharged and spilt and diseased and which dies, life is denied, it is sapped, it is drained, it is lost. Okay, so this is really important as we come to our understanding of what unholiness is. Everything that is connected with death, everything which is connected with disease or decay and with the loss of life is unholy. So, unholiness and impurity is death-dealing, life-force-losing, life-sapping, and life-denying. And the ancients knew what we know, which is death is the antithesis, the polar opposite of life. And so if we know already, and we've established in the context, and we've seen it already for the stuff that Bethany has done, that God is the ultimate of all life and abundance. He is the pinnacle, the limitless force and energy and person that brings life, i.e. holiness. If God is like that, then death is the ultimate unholiness, the ultimate impurity, the ultimate uncleanliness. And so therefore, that was one of the main reasons why you weren't allowed in the temple to transgress into the temple, to violate the temple, because death wasn't tolerated in God's presence. The holy temple could not be polluted by disease and decay and death and anything which sapped life. So bathing, ritual washing, purification had to happen when disease and death touched things. And that ritual, those rituals, then brought life back. It brought renewal and wholeness and healing. And so we're now getting to the definition of what holiness is within Levitical law. You see, holiness is not a standard of morality that we've got to achieve. It's not a superior quality of Christian existence. It's not a higher plane of righteousness that you walk around as a holy person, emitting holiness wherever you go by your words and your thoughts and your actions. Holiness in Levitical concepts, and we'll see in a moment elsewhere, is radically different from that. And we've got to fast forward about 600 years to get an idea of this, to Isaiah chapter 6, where here we have a prophet who has a vision of the temple, and he's petrified. He's bricking himself because he's in the temple and he feels unholy, unworthy. And if you're unholy and unworthy in the temple, what happens to you? What happened to Nadab and Abihu? You get fried. You get consumed by the fire of God's presence. So no wonder he's scared. In the beginning of Isaiah 6, it says, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord." You can't come into the temple. But he's got this vision of himself in the temple. A seraphim, an angel, a mixture of a bodily being and an angelic being, comes and puts a holy hot coal on his lips. And remember, if you were here last week, the coal of Abihu and Nadab. the unauthorized coal which they brought into the temple, which made them unclean. They overstepped the mark and they were consumed. So here we have the concept of a holy coal, an authorized coal, in the temple, in the vision of the temple, and it touches the lips of this unholy person who is not destroyed, but transformed. This is a radical development of what is happening in Leviticus, because the Seraphim then announces, your guilt is departed and your sin is blotted out. This is a reversal of Levitical procedure. Because, of course, in Leviticus, normally when something is unholy, diseased, unworthy, impure and decaying, it transfers its unholiness to an object or to a person and pollutes the sacred space. Here we have a pure coal of the temple transferring its purity to Isaiah, an unholy and unworthy person. Not destroyed, but transformed. So that's Isaiah. We move on to an image, another image of the temple by another prophet, Ezekiel. And Jeff has already talked about this, unrehearsed, unplanned, on our table. Another vision of the temple. He sees water coming from the temple. At first a little trickle, and then it is pouring from the temple, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it's cascading down from the temple like a river rushing through the land. And I'm just going to read some of the words that this is and how it describes and what is happening here from Ezekiel 47. He said to me, mortal or young man, have you seen this? And he led me back along the bank of the river. And as I came back, I saw on the bank of the river a great many trees on the one side and on the other. He said to me, this water flows towards the eastern region and down towards the Arabah. And when it enters the sea of stagnant waters, the water will become fresh. Wherever the river goes, every living creature that swarms will live. And there will be many fish once these waters reach there. It will become fresh and everything will live where the river goes. And on the banks of both sides of the river, there will be all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither, nor their fruit fail, but they will bear fresh fruit every month because the water for them flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be food and their leaves for healing. Now, if you are following, and I hope you are, you get an idea of what is happening here. This temple of holiness, of God's presence, flowing a river of purity, of fresh water, that goes down to the sea, which is polluted and foul and filthy and stagnant. And do you know what we call that river? That sea, the Dead Sea. Isn't that beautiful? The Dead Sea is the vision that Isaiah sees when the temple going into what is dead and bringing out life. What happens when this gushing, flowing water from the temple hits? Life happens. Streams of fish. Polluted sea becomes fresh with trees and growth and vegetation. And the sacred space of the temple brings life, emits life. It turns death into abundance and wholeness and healing. This is a vision of holiness. This is a work of holiness. Holiness is the transformation of what is dead, what is diseased, what is decaying into abundance and life. It is not moral piety or goodness or having nice thoughts about someone or not smoking or drinking or going to the pictures or reading the wrong magazines or having all the puritanical things that we've had etched into our minds and our heads about what is holy and how you should be a holy person. And there was a final twist in the development of this. Jesus. So Jesus is the embodiment of God's holiness. We know that. That's what he talked about. So the embodiment of life, beauty, abundance. The pinnacle of all those things. And when he goes around, he touches people who are impure and unholy. And when he touches them, according to Levitical law, their impurity, their disease and decay should transfer it to Jesus. So Jesus becomes impure, because that's what Leviticus says. But as Isaiah and Ezekiel take us towards, the temple emits and flows holiness, holy water. So Jesus' purity and holiness transfers to them and heals them and brings them to wholeness. And you know, this is amazing. Well, I'm excited about it anyway. I don't care about you. Do you know the three categories of people and situations that Jesus most often transfers his holiness to? Those with skin diseases, a woman with the hemorrhage of blood, dead people, Lazarus and Jairus' daughter. You'd have thought he'd have been reading Leviticus. You'd have thought that the gospel writers would have understood the holiness code, because that's what they were saying here. The picture of Leviticus is these three death-dealing, painful, diseased, decaying conditions and states. And here Jesus is seen to transfer his holiness, his goodness, his abundance, his life onto those three sets of people. Read it in the Gospels. It penetrates the whole of the Gospels of the kind of people that Jesus changes and transforms and doesn't get polluted. He doesn't get changed, but he transforms them. And of course, in this unholiest of weeks, not a holy week, the unholiest of weeks, when death enveloped Jesus, death of betrayal, of denial, of shame, of torture, of humiliation, Jesus embraced the opposite of what he is. He became the ultimate unholiness, which is, now by our definition, death. To give us the ultimate holiness, which is life. So can you see how this is developing when it gets to Jesus? Jesus is saying that his church are streams of living water. It's as if, again, Jesus has been reading the prophet Isaiah. What happened with the temple and with the holy water? What did it do? It flowed out from the temple and transformed the world. Everything will live where the river flows. And Jesus compares his church, Christians, you and I, as God's temples, with water of life flowing out from us. God's holy presence flowing from these temples, going into the world, bringing holiness, life, healing, hope, abundance, fruitfulness, growth. And that is the final and full understanding of what holiness means when it comes from Leviticus through the prophets to Jesus and then out via us as God's temple. And let us circle back to Leviticus, the ritual holiness laws, the regulations around skin diseases and bodily discharges and dead bodies extend to other areas of life. And in chapter 18 and 19, I just want to do a quick exercise. I want you to turn to your Bibles and look at chapters 18 and identify the areas of life where holiness extends to, where life goes out. So you'll need to look through, skim read those passages and see the themes that are coming out, which Leviticus covers in terms of the holiness laws and regulations. What areas of life does holiness or should holiness extend to? And then we'll come back and share a few of those themes. So as you've discussed, we've seen that the Levitical code of holiness, abundant life, extends to so many areas of life. We have commerce, festivals, holidays, social justice, in animal welfare, in immigration, fashion, sexual intimacy, time, agriculture, diet and food, what we eat, worship and other rituals. This is what I call holy, holy, what we need to be as life flows through every area of our personal, corporate, communal, societal existence. We're called to be holy, holy. Now we're starting to realise what holiness is really about. What Leviticus points to, what Isaiah and Ezekiel are leading to, what Jesus is the fullness of, that it's not about morality or piety or being good as such, but it is about resisting and raging against and opposing all that is anti-life and death-dealing. The unholiness of inequality, of hate, of sexism, of racism, of violence, of poverty, of greed. These things are an affront to God, not because they do not reach God's holiness standards, as if this is some kind of level of holiness which these do not get up to, but because ultimately these things deal in death. They are anti-life. And so, as part of our understanding about what it means to be holy people, we've got to understand where our lives give life, share and flow from us in healing and abundance and growth and fruitfulness, and where they deal in death. And that is something hard for us to assess. It arrests us to think about not just holiness in a moral standard way, but holiness in terms of what is life-giving or what is death-dealing. Because holiness flowing from us, essentially, is the opposite of the death-dealing. It is to pursue and chase and dream and pray for and work for all that gives life. So justice and doing a work of justice and praying for justice is an act of holiness. Kindness, patience, compassion, these are acts of holiness. Generosity, what we do with money will indicate how holy we are. Whether what we do with our money and our resources is life-giving and affirming and fruitful and positive and abundant, not only for ourselves but for other people, or whether it is death-dealing, whether it consumes for the sake of consumption, whether it hoards, whether it is selfish, whether it is self-orientated. So when we think about imitating God, imitating the ultimate expression of holiness, which is the life of God, then we've got to see ourselves as vessels of divine life with holiness flowing through us in these acts of justice and mercy and generosity and kindness and patience. So one final thing as we leave, as an exercise to go home with. Choose one area of these wide panoramic themes that we've looked at in Leviticus, which talks about holiness and purity and life-giving affirmation and wholeness. And try to identify perhaps one of those themes that is unholy, with his death dealing, which is anti-life, and consider where you can pray, act, collaborate, change and transform that situation into holiness to bring life. It may be a relationship. It may be just simply a conversation that you may be having with a work colleague or a neighbour or somebody in your family. It may be government policy on something that you identify as death dealing and you want to change it. So we join a campaign, we write to an MP, we go on a march, we do something to show holiness, life, to reverse that death dealing policy. It may be a work culture that you think is destructive, that is unequal, that is unfair. These are simple ways in which we can understand how life flows from us as a group of people, as a church, and into the world in our specific places. Be holy people this week. Be life-giving, affirming, fruitful people that bring wholeness and healing and health and wellness to our world around us where we live and work. Let's pray.